Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. 1989 was a momentous year in the history of the 20th century. In that year, the world witnessed the breathtaking implosion of communism in Eastern Europe, highlighted most vividly by the collapse of the Berlin Wall on November 9th. Earlier, in the spring of that year, the opposition party Solidarity won a critical set of elections in Poland, indicating widespread discontent with communist rule in that nation. Later, in the summer of 1989, the Hungarian government opened its borders with Austria, resulting in a flood of individuals seeking to leave their homes in the East for freedom in the West. The images of Hungarians and East Germans abandoning their cars and keys to their apartment in order to cross over to the West more quickly was the most stunning bit of evidence to me of how much people value political, economic, and religious freedom. The fall of the Berlin Wall was quickly followed by the collapse of communist governments throughout the region, including Czechoslovakia and Romania. The Baltic states of Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia soon declared their independence from the Soviet Union, and by 1991, the Soviet Union itself came crumbling down. What role did religion play in this collapse? More specifically, what role did the Catholic Church play? Today, I am pleased to have on the show James Felak, professor of history at the University of Washington and author of After Hitler, Before Stalin, Catholics, Communists, and Democrats in Slovakia, 1945 to 1948. Professor Felak is currently working on a manuscript detailing the life history of Pope John Paul II, and he is here with us today to talk about the role of the Vatican in bringing down the Iron Curtain. Professor Felak, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony.
Before getting to the Vatican's role in the downfall of communism in the 1980s, I would like to talk a bit about Pope John Paul II, who seems to be a uniquely important individual when it comes to this story, both because of his charisma and because of his background growing up in a communist nation. What can you tell us about John Paul II's formative years in Poland, and how may that have shaped his views on communism and his subsequent tenure as Pope?
Mm-hmm. Okay, one of the things, you know, he grows up during the interwar period, the 19-teens and 20s, so he's in 30s, so he's growing up he's already an adult before the communists take over his country.
Okay.
So his formative experiences through the 20s and 30s, he's going to be very much, he's from a small town called Wadowice. He's going to grow up in a community that had a lot of Jews, and you know, there's a tension between Poles and the Jewish citizens historically in Poland, but John Paul came from a family that was actually anti-Semitic. So he grew up actually having good personal relationship with Jews. He carried that with him through his whole life. He also...
Now, you didn't say anti-Semitic, you said anti-Semitic. So
yeah.
Almost two antis make a pro.
It's a pro, almost like, yeah.
Okay.
So it was a family that really, really was against the traditional negative views about Jews. So he's gonna bring that with him into the papacy. He's also had a very strong attachment to youth, and this is going to play into his activities in Poland as well. As a young pastor, he was really a youth pastor. He developed close relations with college students. He went hiking and kayaking and whatnot with them and maintained those relationships through his whole priestly career. And as Pope, he put big emphasis on outreach toward youth, and when he visited communist Poland, he would try to have events geared very much toward youth and really try to inspire and motivate encourage Polish youth. In terms of living under oppressive political system, the real defining moment for John Paul was when his country was occupied by Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union in 1939. So the Germans come in from the West, Poles start to run to the East into the arms of the Soviet Union, taking the other half of their country. And so he ended up living in this situation, and he ended up on the German the German half, and he was, during the war, he was involved in resistance movement, but not the military resistance. He was underground theater. His real love was theater. He was an actor and a playwright, and that's what he was wanted to go into for a career. And so he was about putting on plays that the Nazis didn't want Poles to be doing, plays with sort of, you know, historical, patriotic significance or things that were a little too modern, the Nazis didn't like. And then he was also involved, but he had to work in a quarry and then a chemical factory. He was, you know, really a forced laborer under the Nazis as well. So he had that firsthand experience of being a persecuted minority under an oppressive regime of foreigners.
Let me go back and address this issue of the plays that he did. Now, he wrote plays fairly prolifically.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and were these the plays that he wrote during this period in the early 1940s, were they directed toward Nazi occupation? Were they protest plays, or were they just historical plays?
No, they were just, like, for example, his most famous one is about marriage.
Mm-hmm.
It's about three couples, a couple with a happy marriage, a couple with a troubled marriage, and then a child from one couple marries a child from the other couple. And it just talks about, very theological. They're not traditional plays. He uses more modern sort of avant-garde techniques, but he wasn't writing. His writings weren't political in that sense.
Okay, as interesting to notice, because later on when we talk about the communist era, this is that comes.
Sure.
They wanted to see if he had a protesting background.
But it's the occupation in which he decides he wants to become a priest.
Okay.
So when he's starting college when all of this happens, and he ends up joining an underground seminary. Where the Nazis weren't allowing Poles to enter the seminary, so he had to sort of secretly attend the seminary in Krakow, Poland. And then, while he's in seminary, the Nazis lose the war, and the Soviet Union occupies the country. And so his early years as a priest will be under the Soviets, and he's going to rise up pretty quickly and become, by the 50s, he's going to become a bishop. He'll be ultimately Archbishop of Krakow, which is one of the major jobs in the Polish church. So he's going to make his whole career in Poland under the communist occupation, pretty much.
Now, is his rise through the ranks of the Catholic Church during this period of time due to the fact that there weren't many people entering the seminary at the time, so there was a shortage of priests, and, we need a bishop, there wasn't anybody around? Or was it part and parcel of his charisma and his motivation and incredible intellect?
He was smart, he was energetic, he was well-liked, he was charismatic. And he was, and one of the things that he did, and this was so crucial for the whole John Paul story, is he was very interested in dialogue with people that he didn't agree with, or people that he could have a certain common interest with, but also other significant differences. And particularly, he dialogued with non-Catholic, non-Christian intellectuals. So already from the 50s, he was active in meeting with them as bishop. He was... The Catholic Church had a magazine, they still do, called or a newspaper called Tygodnik Powszechny, kind of it means like universal news or Catholic news.
Mm-hmm.
And John Paul was active in publishing in that. And that was a journal that brought together all sorts of points of view. There was nothing like it in the entire communist world. There probably aren't too many things like it in the Western world at that time. He brought writers from France, Germany, England, Latin America, plus the Polish Catholic writers, Polish non-Catholic writers, Marxists. They got involved in dialogues and discussions, debates on those pages. The communists, would censor it, but it was freer than anything published in the entire communist world, and it really became such an impressive venue for debate and discussion that atheists and agnostics and people that generally would want nothing to do with the Catholic Church subscribed to it, read it, talked about it, published in it. And John Paul built these links. And so years later, when Poland is unifying against the communist regime, the Catholic Church and the secular intellectuals and the working class, all those groups are going to be linked together. And one of the key parts of this link was the Catholic Church with the intellectuals, and it's through the work of people like John Paul and Tygodnik Powszechny that was able to come about.
So this is rooted back in the 1950s.
This is back in the 50s, by mid-50s or early 60s, he's involved in these sorts of things.
Absolutely. Was this just a pure intellectual endeavor, or did he have motives at this time of, yes, I want to challenge communism, and possibly with a vision that we could topple it someday?
Boy, that's a good question. It's hard to, you know, get inside somebody's mind what they're thinking 50, 60 years ago. But, you know, he definitely had a, you know, as a Catholic, he had a vision of how society ought to be functioning. There should be a rights for the working class. There should be a just economic system. There should be a government that's responsive to the people. There's lots of ways that can be played out. So I don't know that Jean-Paul had some sort of a blueprint of what he really wanted Poland to look like, but from very early on, position as bishop, he's very much working to and build these links with people that are interested in making Poland a better place.
Mm-hmm. So how did he advance through the Catholic Church and eventually get to become Pope? I want to talk about the election mm-hmm. to the papacy in a minute, but how does he get from being a newspaper editor, parish priest, to becoming archbishop rather quickly, and the effect of that on his career?
Okay, well, you know, it's an institution where you can move ahead through competence and ability. In fact, unlike the Communist Party, where you are often rewarded for political loyalty, the Catholic Church rewards you for loyalty as well. But Jean-Paul was very smart. He was extremely well educated. He was someone who had a lot of energy. You know, we especially younger people remember him. I mean, today remember him as old and sick and dying of Parkinson's disease.
Right.
But he was an athlete. He played soccer. He skied both Nordic and Alpine, probably until he was, you know, well into his 60s or even 70s. He was a very vigorous guy, very upbeat. He was a guy that really what the Polish Church needed at the time. There was, you know, there are different factions in the Polish Church. There's a very traditional faction that's very nationalistic, very much wants to go back to the pre-war periods. And John Paul was really, in a lot of ways, a reformer. He was someone that wanted to energize the church, bring it up to date. He was an important figure at the Second Vatican Council. And that sort of current within Polish Christianity was, you know, sort of coming to the fore. When someone becomes a bishop in Poland, the communists have to have a certain amount of approval. You know, the Catholic Church works out deals with most dictatorships, where,
right.
you know, the church nominates certain candidates and the communists have a right to veto them or some sort of a interaction. And when we know this now because the documents are available, but when Karol Wojtyła, which was his name before he was Pope,
And I have to thank you for being the first one to pronounce that, as my Polish is not all that good, even though I have a Polish background. Karol Wojtyła.
So he was of the, I think, maybe three candidates, he was the one the communists were the most happy with, because they thought, well, he's not really political. He's into ideas and culture and intellectual things, and he's not going to be out there making too much trouble. And that was a miscalculation, because the kind of trouble that he's going to end up making actually was more deeper and profound than someone who was simply looking at the surface politics.
Yeah, one of the great ironies of history, I would guess.
Oh, yeah.
So, so let's talk about his election mm-hmm. to the papacy. And if he's John Paul II. There happened to be a John Paul I mm-hmm. who lasted about a month,
right.
if I'm correct.
Yep.
And if I know my Vatican history at all, there was, first of all, he was unique in being one of the very first Italian popes in several centuries. Non-Italian popes in several centuries. And during the election process in 1978, there were two Italian candidates that were neck and neck for the papacy, I would guess. So how does this guy from Poland squeeze into the papacy? And was there any conscious design to bring in a non-Italian pope to challenge communism in the Eastern Bloc, or was this just fortuitous that he happened to be there at the right place at the right time?
That's a good question. So one of the things to keep in mind, he's the first non-Italian pope since the time of Martin Luther. So it's over 400 years. They had a Dutch pope. in the 1520s. That was the last non-Italian. So there was, you know, of the non-Italian leadership among the cardinals of the Catholic Church, certainly there's a sense that maybe a non-Italian, you know, it kind of broadens the church, makes it more global when you have a people from different parts of the world.
I guess 400 years of pent-up demand.
Right. So there's certainly that's a consideration. But when you think about, you know, was this something the church consciously did as a way to undermine communism? I don't think so for three reasons. First, when Paul VI died and they met to elect a pope, they actually elected another Italian, John Paul I. So it wasn't, you know, so already, you know, Wojtyla was only up for election because John Paul I died so quickly.
And he was fairly young. John Paul I was fairly young by papal standards, I think mid-60s or so.
Yeah. He'd had some health problems, so okay. It wasn't a surprise that he died so quickly. But the other thing is, Wojtyla really made a reputation at Vatican II, dealing mm-hmm. with issues that weren't connected really with communism, just with reforming the church and the church's role in the world. And he was very well liked. He made a lot of connections. So that was... And one of the interesting things about Vatican II is, you know, the Catholic Church under Pope Pius XII, who was pope from 1939 to 1958, was very, very anti-communist. And Pius, you know, challenged the communists, denounced the communists, got into all sorts of fights with communists as they were taking over Eastern Europe. But then John the 23rd became the pope, who was much more open to positive relations with the communist world. And it's not just so much that the church changed, but actually, you know, communism had changed too. Because, you know, Pius XII was generally dealing with Stalin.
Right.
And now you're dealing with Khrushchev and a Soviet Union that's talking about peaceful coexistence.
Détente is on the horizon.
That sort of thing, yes. So it's a different world. But what's very interesting, had John the 23rd not come along and improved relations with the Soviet Union, it's doubtful that Wojtyla would have been allowed to go to Vatican II. Because the Soviet Union kind of gave the green light for a number of these East European bishops to be allowed to travel to Rome, precisely because it was getting along better with the Vatican. But so I think, so Wojtyla, he gets elected, I think, largely through the contacts he makes at Vatican II and in the whole process of the council. He was just very impressive guy, made a lot of, you know, a lot of people's careers are advanced when they go to some, you know, important conference and other people get to see them and know them. And also, if you think about it, when he's elected in 1978, relations with the Soviet bloc was not at the top of the list of Catholic Church interests. You know, they were much more interested in poverty, in the developing world, in communist insurrections in Latin America.
Right.
And this idea of how do we get along with the Eastern bloc was not really pressing. In fact, that was the age of détente, the late 70s.
Right.
So it really, in a certain sense, you could say it was fortuitous, or Catholic would say providential. You know, it's a higher plan that's being played out, but the Vatican actually, or, you know, the College of Cardinals actually consciously chose him as a way to undermine communism. I don't think so. I think it was an after effect mm-hmm. of his election. But there's a lot about the man that would be a challenge to the communists that would be hard to...
Let me take a sidestep here mm-hmm. before we get to his challenging of communism. Mm-hmm. You raise a very interesting point here about John Paul II's or Wojtyla's role at Vatican Council II. Now, John Paul II as Pope is known as somebody who rolled back some of the Vatican mm-hmm. Council II reforms. Yet at the time in the early 60s, you're saying he plays an influential role here. How can we reconcile these? What role did he play
sure.
at Vatican II?
I think it's an unfair stereotype to say that he's trying to roll back Vatican II. And there's a word, what's it, a restorationist. I've heard some commentators use that, you know, John Paul and now Benedict XVI, they want to restore the pre-Vatican II church. Simply very, very inaccurate. I mean, those guys are very, first of all, they shaped Vatican II themselves, and they also are very much shaped by it. But within the Catholic Church, you know, as the Vatican Council teachings came out in 1965 and became the, you know, foundational documents for the church in the 20th century, as with any documents, there's issues of interpretation and implementation.
Right.
And so some Catholics what they call kind of the spirit of Vatican II. You know, Vatican II started the reforms going, and we want to just keep the reforms going in our application and even bring in new reforms. And other Catholics reacted against that and wanted to sort of really sort of slow down that kind of a process. Remember, the Vatican Council itself reached these conclusions and formulated and approved, ratified these documents through acts of compromise. So, you know, the more reform-minded people would push for some pretty sharp reforms, and then conservatives would react, and then the Pope would sort of try to work out some kind of a compromise, so text would get, you know, revised and amended, because the idea was to build as big a consensus as possible.
Right.
So you get these documents that can be interpreted in different ways, and some people were hoping to see, you know, even greater reforms. Other people were hoping to see the reform slow down. And John Paul was one of those guys who was kind of, in a certain sense, in the middle there. I mean, he liked the reforms, but he didn't want people going beyond the letter of Vatican II off into all sorts of new directions. But in a lot of ways, he's not so much different than Pope Paul VI, who's oftentimes seen as very liberal, mm-hmm. in that the John Paul, both of those guys were trying to manage a church that had serious divisions. People were pulling to the right, people were pulling to the left. You want to hold the church together. You don't want to have a schism. But the difference was Paul VI was really, in a lot of ways, almost overwhelmed by the job, it seemed, very cautious, whereas John Paul was very confident. It was kind of like a young, energetic, confident pope that really wanted to take the church in a... and sort of implement Vatican II with confidence, not like, oh, gee, we're too old-fashioned, we better get up with the times, but more like, you know, this is the Catholic vision for the 20th, 21st century, and let's go out there and make it happen. And he had a real, and that charisma, I think, helped get him elected to Pope, this whole approach he was taking. But I said, undermining confidence, I do not think was the Vatican priority, okay. And we never really know because these are secret elections.
The smoke that comes up and the speculation of who will be the next pope is a very mysterious process. So let's start there then. Let's mm-hmm. start at late 1978, mm-hmm. early 1979. Pope John Paul II is now the pope. Mm-hmm. What are some of the first things that he does that gives us an indication that he is going to take a stand against communism?
Well, his very first encyclical, and the Pope's first encyclical, the encyclical is the letter they're writing for the church, laying out their teachings. It can be on all sorts of particular issues. John Paul's first encyclical is on human dignity, you know, the mm-hmm. human person and human dignity. And defense of human dignity is something that really has to go on in just about all, in all societies, really.
Right.
But it has a particular resonance in communist society because they were violating it in so many ways. So just the fact that the Pope's going to make that sort of the centerpiece of his pontificate, defense of human dignity, automatically is kind of a challenge to the communist regimes. And then the really big thing he does
did the communist governments of Poland, of the Soviet Union at the time, did Brezhnev feel that this was a threat, or was this, you know, another pope just writing a document about human dignity?
Well, they were concerned that the pope was Polish. And that was really, some of the Soviet documents came out, and, you know, they're closed again now, but they came out in the early 90s, and Moscow was very, very worried, as was the Polish Communist Party, very worried about this. And it worried for several reasons. First of all, it puts the world media spotlight on Poland.
Right.
You know, if it was another Italian pope, he says something about Poland, that's not going to be front page news. But now you have a Polish pope. Just his election is major world news. And then when something happens in Poland, he can speak out, and that's going to get coverage. Secondly, you have somebody in Rome now who actually understands the communist world, mm-hmm. that really knows, and the people there know that he understands the situation. And, you know, one of the big advantages Catholics have over Protestants, at least, is the priests hear confessions. So, you know, so John Paul's heard, you know, as a priest in Poland, as a bishop even, you know, thousands, probably tens of thousands of confessions. So he's hearing Polish people talking about the intimate details of their lives, or the temptations they face, the compromises they make, the anxieties that they're under in this system. So he really knew what it was like to be a common person living under communist regime.
Let me stop you on this point. Mm-hmm. You're in point two here. Mm-hmm. This is absolutely fascinating. It goes back to one of my favorite books in the social sciences by Timur Kuran called Private Truths, Public Lies, which is a book about how people in public put on a facade thinking that everybody else likes a certain party or likes a certain political system. Mm-hmm. And what you mentioned here is very profound, especially in that time, as scholars looking at the Soviet Union in the late 1970s and 1980s, we had no idea that it was going to fall apart in a decade's time. Anybody who says that was either considered a lunatic or silly.
Right.
But here, what you're saying is that there's this unique institution, the Catholic Church, and a unique individual who becomes Pope, who hears all the private truths, not the public lies, the ones that Solzhenitsyn would talk about as well. Mm-hmm. He hears the private truths. So he has as you're saying, a much better understanding of what the communist system is and invariably how weak it might be.
And also, he's living under it. And a big advantage he also has is, traditionally, a lot of times Catholic priests are, they get sent to seminary when they're about 14 years old, and they're, isolated from women, and they're isolated from the, the normal society. And then, when they're 25, they're sent out into the world as priests. And that was a conscious policy, dates back to the Counter-Reformation. And in 20th century, there starts to be move away from that. So Wojtyla is a guy he's a college student, he's working in a quarry, he's working in a chemical plant, he's acting, he's got female friends, he's hanging out with Jewish people from the theater world. He's someone that's really been out in the world getting human experience. And so when he goes to the seminary, he's already a mature adult that really has a feel for the world, living out in the world as a normal, common, non-clerical person. So he can bring all of that knowledge into his priestly vocation, whereas, some kid that got sent off, some Italian kid whose parents had 12 kids and they wanted one of them to be a priest, so they sent him off to a seminary when he was 13. He's not going to have that kind of and that credibility, jump on a real credibility, and people knew. And also, he suffered. In Eastern Europe particularly, you get a lot of credibility if you've suffered. Mm-hmm. And here's John Paul. Here's a guy. His mother died when he was about 5 years old. His brother died, his only brother, when he was about 12 or 13. His father died around the time of his first year at college. So he lost his entire immediate family by the time he was 21. And so he's already just personally suffered. And then as soon as all that happens, the Nazis have taken over his country. He's forced to work in a factory. And then the Soviet Union takes over the country. So he's experienced a lot of this stuff, literally firsthand. He's not just learning about it, reading about it.
Right.
But it's his life story.
Yeah,
and so now he's the Pope. And, of course, the Pope's kind of alone at the pinnacle of an institution of a billion members. But people know that he's one of us. He was one of us. He lived our life. He walked our walk with us, and that gives him a lot of credibility. So when he starts to address these kinds of issues, people know he knows what he's talking about.
So to go back and talk about how the Soviets are starting to sweat the election of this Polish Pope.
Okay,
he's first of all, he's from Poland, and he has a unique lectern from which to speak from.
Yep.
Number two, he knows, and they know he knows what is knowledgeable about the system. And that to me is an absolutely fascinating point. They said there was a third point. Was that the suffering aspect?
That he suffered, he had that sort of credibility. And just his whole teaching, he's focusing on human dignity.
Is
going to automatically, and things like the rights of the worker, and your rights as a human being, and what are the limitations of what the government can do to you. I mean, all of these things are going to be important parts of his teaching, and he talks about it globally. I mean, when he goes to Latin America, he'll complain about dictatorships. When he goes to the United States, he'll complain about abortion or death penalty or whatever. I mean, he's tries to be global, but the message was particularly resonant in Poland because he's Polish, and because this is a system that's supposedly the society of the workers, the worker state, but worker rights are being violated. And here's somebody that's talking about, your rights that you have as a human person. That's a big issue with Vatican II. The Catholic Church really starts talking about human rights especially with Vatican II. Now, they've defended the marginalized, they defended, you know, mentally ill, mentally retarded people, certain oppressed groups for, you know, centuries, sometimes right from the beginning. But human rights becoming such a fundamental part of Catholic teaching is really starts to develop in the 20th century, and Vatican II is sort of the loudest expression of that. So he's very much in line with that. That's when he looks at any situation, first thing on his mind is, you know, is human dignity being affirmed here, or is it being violated?
So third,
that's
point
a dangerous
there,
message in
yeah,
the
country. Soviets are sweating this message. Yeah. The Polish communists are sweating this message. But right now that's a message. So what actions does Pope John Paul II take? We're talking 1979. Now, one of his, if I remember correctly, one of the first actions that he does as Pope was to go back to
the
Poland.
Visit. This was incredible. Because let me step back a bit. Poland was a unique situation. No other communist country was in the same boat as Poland, in the sense that if you're a communist in Poland, here's what you're up against. You have a country that historically has had bad relations with the Soviet Union and with Russia in general.
Right.
So you're representing a system that's seen as being imposed upon you by your centuries-long enemy. Secondly, Poland was in a huge economic mess by the 70s. They borrowed tons of monies in the early 70s during era of detente. Western banks were loaning them money. Our Western governments, really, were guaranteeing these loans. And so they spent a lot of money to sort of try to keep people happy and get the economy jump-started, and that was starting to fall apart. You know, when the oil crisis started to hit and recessions in the West and Poland couldn't export the kind of goods it wanted, they start to run into food shortages, enormous debt, long lines to get basic products, especially meat. So there's an economic crisis. Thirdly, you have a working class in Poland that already since the 50s has been combative. It's risen up. It's had strikes, demonstrations when it was upset with government policies. And so it's a situation of large-scale labor unrest. And then you have really tens of thousands of intellectuals who by the 60s and 70s were turning against, especially by late 60s, turning against communism, starting to just be so cynical and disgusted with the regime and looking for alternatives, and starting to, you had a whole underground in Poland that was by the late 70s, you could buy underground newspapers on the street in Poland, paper boys sold them at the corner. It was so, it was so pervasive. So many people. Finally, you had a Catholic Church that had a lot of prestige, a lot of influence, a real voice in Poland. And when you put all those things together, think, you're a communist. You're sitting in this country where you know, like, you know, people are Catholic. They're going to church. They don't like the Soviet Union. The economy's a mess. You have hundreds of thousands of workers willing to go on strike when there's a crisis, and you have tens of thousands of intellectuals that are willing to support things like that. So even if a Polish pope was not elected, the communists would have had a huge mess on their hands. Wojtyla does, when he gets elected, he goes to Poland to visit. And they wanted him to come, he wanted to come on the feast of Saint Stanisław. And Stanisław is a Polish saint from the Middle Ages who's a kind of a Polish version of Thomas Becket. He was a bishop who was killed by the king for speaking out against political injustice. So the communists really didn't want Wojtyla or John Paul to visit for the Feast of Saint Stanisław.
Now, how soon is this?
In fact, it was an anniversary. This is in May of 79.
So we're talking maybe 5-6 months after he was elected.
Yeah, he was elected in October. He was elected on my birthday, actually. And then he, so by May he wants to come. And they say, no, we want you to come in August. And they want him to come in August when everybody's on vacation and he, as a compromise, he comes in June. He moved the St. Stanisław celebrations from May to June. It was the 1100th anniversary of Stanisław's death. Mm-hmm. So he's Pope. He could do that. He moves the celebration into June, and it comes for 9 days instead of 2 days, and it becomes this enormous event. And literally hundreds of thousands of people turn up day after day after day as he tours the country, and the whole visit was choreographed. He went to specific sites of importance to Polish political and religious history. He addressed a lot of these important questions about human dignity, and he gave a big talk in Warsaw to hundreds of thousands of people on Jesus Christ is the meaning of history, and so on and so on. And what this did, up until that time, Polish people knew that a lot of people were upset with the regime. But there was no way to link them all together. You know, you had angry workers, you had angry intellectuals, you had the church. But what John Paul did, when he comes and you start seeing, you know, 500, 600,000 people are all out on some big square or in some stadium, and they're all chanting and cheering, and they're all saying the same thing, and they're starting to realize, my gosh, you know. Or when the communists get up on stage to introduce John Paul, and people will whistle or boo, and you start to get this sense that there's a lot of us out here that really don't like this regime or this system.
It's interesting to just draw a parallel with this, because I know John Paul II mm-hmm. drew massive crowds mm-hmm. wherever he went. And in my own studies of Latin America, I know in 1979 when he visited Mexico, mm-hmm. The Mexican regime, mm-hmm. which considered Catholicism to be a non-entity,
right,
or illegal.
That's a clerical regime, yeah.
What you didn't advertise that uh-huh. John Paul II would come, but when he did, a million people filled the center of Mexico City, mm-hmm. and you know, there's people within the regime at the time would stand out on the balcony of the presidential palace and look out and say, "We have a problem here. We can't pay 1,000 people to come and rally for
right.
us." And this guy with no advertising
right.
brings, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of people. Same thing is happening in Poland
yeah.
here.
Yeah. And he's a native son coming back, too. So that's adding a whole other dimension to this. So that, and different commentators, in fact, non-believers, like Adam Michnik, who's one of the leading Polish dissidents, said, you know, this is like, I think he called it Poland's second baptism. This is like, it's like a national rebirth. It was like really it was a time when Poles, in Poland during communism, they referred to the communists as they or them. That was the word for communists. There's even a famous book called Them, Stalin's Polish Puppets, which was a study of the early communist leadership in mm-hmm. Poland. And so, you know, if Poles talking about communists, they'd say, oh, he's one of them, or she's one of them, or I wonder what they're going to do about that. And what happened when John Paul went, you know, everybody knew who them was. It's the regime, it's the people working for the regime. But Paul's didn't really have as much of a sense of who is us. Who are we?
Mm-hmm.
And when you start to see, you know, nearly hundreds of thousands of people turning out all over the country, lining the roads from the airport to downtown, packing the squares, packing the stadiums, and they're saying, you know, we want God, we love the Pope, on and on and on. There's this sense that there's a lot of people out there. And of course, you know, the church was also very consciously trying to catechize its parishioners and things like human rights and human dignity. And so one year after John Paul, a little more than a year after John Paul's visit, you get a more social unrest, you get a labor strikes, and it turns into the Solidarity Movement, where practically the whole country goes on strike, creates a labor union that the communists are pressured into accepting, and then
what do you do with a labor union in a workers' paradise, right?
Right. Oh yeah, and what I think is so crucial about John Paul, and this sometimes I think gets missed, is he's really one of his major contributions is keeping things peaceful, because you know Poland was having a lot of Poland could have had all sorts of trouble in 1980s, became extremely violent. I mean, it could have civil war, it could have Soviet invasion. And the Catholic Church in Poland, not just John Paul, but the Polish Church, and this is why I don't like to lump the church in with the opposition. The church was really kind of a third force. Because, you know, you had the opposite, you had the angry workers, you had the intellectuals that really were upset with the system, you had the system itself and its representatives. And the church was kind of in the middle in the sense that the Catholic Church wanted to sort of push the, you know, protect the workers and intellectuals, and I'll give you an example about how they did that in a second, push the regime to reform and calm people down so that there's not going to be a bloodbath. And they managed to transform this country where there was enormous amount of animosity toward the regime and toward Soviet Union, and it transitioned into a normal Western democracy without much violence. It was mm-hmm. really, the church was always, and it goes back to 1956 when the Poles had their first of these series of revolutions. And Cardinal Wyszynski gets released from house arrest. He was the leader of the Polish church at the time. And he comes out and he tells, okay, you know, we all know how to fight for Poland. Now I want everybody to go home and work for Poland. This idea that now it's time to calm down. The regime has made some concessions. Now let's try to build a new society, you know, rebuild Poland.
Right.
And so the church always during these times of crisis would step in and try to calm people down. And in fact, when John Paul's in Warsaw in 79, and he gives a speech to, you know, hundreds of thousands of people about Jesus Christ is the meaning of history, and it was really, in a sense, throwing down the gauntlet to the Communist Party. But one of the next things he does is he lays a wreath at the monument of the Soviet liberators of Warsaw at the end of 1944. It's kind of like, and he was very careful. He made sure that, you know, that the foreign occupation ended in 44. We're not going to call the Soviet Union foreign occupiers. I mean, this idea that you don't want to stir up anti-Russian, anti-Soviet sentiments. He was always careful how he worded things during these visits during the communist period. So this idea that you don't want to create a bloodbath. One of the ways a church protected people. I want to say this because I love this story. When I was an undergraduate here at the University of Washington, I was taking a course on, in fact, a course that I now teach on the history of Eastern Europe, and it was right during all of these events. The Solidarity Movement had just gotten taken over when Poland declared martial law in December of 1981.
Right.
And in spring of that year, there was a big demonstration by the opposition against the regime and against martial law. This is a dangerous thing to do under martial law.
Right.
And there were two UW graduate students that were over there at the time doing their dissertation research, and they went to the demonstration. And they were in the old town of Warsaw, and there was a square there where people were assembling, and the regime sent in the riot police. They were called Zomos. They kind of looked like Darth Vader. They had these black helmets and big shields and weapons and whatnot, and they come marching into the old town from all directions. And so these students, they described it all in a letter they sent back to the professor, and he read it to us in class. It was really exciting to be in school in like May of 1981 or 82 studying Poland, and having students that are actually there involved in some demonstration writing back to describe it all firsthand.
This is the stuff that gives you chills up your spine.
Yeah, it was
great. This is amazing.
And you can get the letters all had to come through, you know, the embassy pouches and things,
because right.
They read all the mail over there and take it. So they're describing it, and, you know, we're running down the street, and we see the Zomos coming at us, and we run down this other street, and the Zomos are coming at us, and we run down this other street, and the Zomos are coming. They're coming from all directions, and then somebody says, if you get to a church, you'll be safe. So we ran to a Catholic church, and once you got on the property of the church, the Zomos didn't touch you. In fact, you could thumb your nose at them, give them the finger, you could do whatever you wanted. They weren't going to touch you. They were under strict rules, like don't mess with the church. And that was one of the things that the Catholic church got itself in a position in Poland where the regime needed the church to keep social peace. And the church knew that. And so the church was able to really be kind of a safe space for people.
Right.
Because there's the sense is that, you know, we can't mess with the church. We can't cross, the regime can't cross certain boundaries without creating, then driving the church totally into the opposition and creating a civil war. Remember, the last thing the communist leaders of Poland wanted, I don't think anybody in Poland wanted a Soviet invasion less than them, because they were the ones that are blamed for it.
Right.
It's like, you know, and the Soviets are already there in Afghanistan. I mean, they were already, in fact, we know today they don't think they had the resources to invade Poland.
But Poland didn't know that.
Poland
at the
didn't
time.
Know that. No,
and
no,
there's
no.
a history of right. Czechoslovakia
right.
in 68,
yep.
Hungary
yep.
in 56.
Gotcha.
You don't want to be Poland 82.
Right. So this role of keeping the peace. And another thing that's fascinating that I found, I'm studying John Paul's visits to Poland, particularly during the communist period. So
mm-hmm.
I've read hundreds and hundreds of pages of Polish text on what he's saying to Poles, all his speeches and sermons and addresses he's giving at all these venues, what he's saying to the government, what he's saying to workers, what he's saying to women, to peasants, and on and on. And one of the things that's real interesting during the first visit is he goes to Częstochowa. It's the monastery in Poland where they have the icon of the Black Madonna. It's this painting of Mary and Jesus from the Middle Ages, and her skin's really dark. And it's like what Our Lady of Guadalupe would be for Mexicans.
Right.
It's like the national symbol. Even though it's not the government symbol, nor is it in Mexico, it's the people's symbol to
right.
a large extent. And so he goes to this venue. He wanted to go to Lublin, where there was a Catholic university, the only religious, you know, even private university in the whole communist world. But they wouldn't let him go there. So the Lublin students came to him. And the government cut off the railroad service and blocked the roads, and a lot of these kids had to walk probably 30 miles to get to the venue. But they show up, and they had issued a protest against the government for obstructing their meeting with John Paul, and also just for the way government was treating students. And John Paul opens his speech by saying, you know, I read your protest, And I totally agree with it. And then he goes on to, and he's very big on encouraging you. You know, being a Christian means taking risks. That's what the gospel's all about. He quotes Jesus Christ telling the apostles they're going to face really difficult lives. And he said, this is good. This is what you should be doing. I support it. And then he says something very interesting that doesn't get play. I've never seen it talked about. Maybe not even in Poland, let alone the West. He says, you know, you shouldn't, it's not good to have an anti-Christian worldview. But if somebody is a sincere Marxist, we should respect that. Because the real problem in Poland is not Marxism, it's opportunism, careerism, it's people that'll follow any kind of an ideology because that's the way you get ahead. And it was very interesting that he said this. And when he comes back in 1987, and he's able to speak much more openly about things.
Right.
Because this is already the Gorbachev era is coming, and he's you know, each one of these visits, he had three visits from 79 till 87. Each one's a little is actually quite different. The first one is the native son coming home as pope, and it's really, really joyful and celebratory. Then he goes in 83 when the cloud of martial law is hanging over Poland, and people are really depressed. And then he goes with just words of encouragement and tries to, you know, talks about all the tragedies of Polish history and how the Poles have survived all those things, and he tells them to keep their chin up. When he comes in 87, things are changing once again. The regime has gotten very liberalized. Gorbachev's in power. It looks like communism is really either on the way out or it's going to change into something not quite...
softer.
Yeah, softer, much softer. And so he's speaking much more freely. And now he's just really laying out there. This is what, you know, he talks to peasants. This is what's wrong with agriculture. He talks to workers. This is what's wrong with the economy. He talks to sick people and doctors and nurses. This is what the mess that they've made out of the, you know, communists have made out of the healthcare system. And on and on and on. So he's able to be much more overt. But also when he starts, you can sense he's also, he can speak openly about the past. So he's really talking about the solidarity, first time ever, he's talking about the Solidarity Union.
Right.
When he goes in 79, it hasn't happened yet. When he goes in 83, he doesn't talk about it directly, but he'll use the word solidarity in his speeches. That we need social solidarity, and of course, read between the lines.
Meaning something
and
different.
People than,
yeah.
cheer, and when they cheer too much, he always tells them, stop, I'm talking, stop cheering. But... He's working between the lines. By 87, he's saying we had this solidarity movement. It was one of the greatest things in the world history. When I went to India, Gandhi's nephew came up to me and hugged me and said, thank you for Poland because of this movement. So he's talking about the past openly, and he's talking about the future in the sense that now he's thinking already in terms of a post-communist Poland. He's worried about brain drain to the West. He's worried about freedom being understood as license instead of in a more morally grounded way. So he's talking about the future, and he also says, you know, the problem still it isn't communism. The problem is sin. This is just a communism kind of a result of just human sin in a lot of ways, and so he's really kind of he's going deeper. I mean, he's when John Paul talks about problems like communism, it's deeper than it's not political. It's philosophical, theological. So you think what's wrong with communism? Okay, well it mucks up the economy, it deprives people of basic civil liberties, all those things are true. But when John Paul talks about it, he takes it several notches deeper. He said, you know, it violates the truth of original sin. Mm-hmm. This idea that you cannot create heaven on earth. You cannot build a utopia just by changing your socioeconomic system. You create hell on earth, in a sense, when you try to do that.
Right.
So he said this inability of recognizing human propensity to sin is a real problem with communism. They think they can really build a new society. When he went to Czechoslovakia, right at the end of 1990, I think it was, in the spring, when he gets off the plane at the airport, one of the first things he says is, I stand here today amidst the ruins of yet another of mankind's failed attempts to build a Tower of Babel. In other words, communism was this utopian dream. We're going to scale heaven using human effort, and it was a total failure because they didn't recognize that humans are tainted by original sin and are going to, there's going to be this propensity to screw things up. You can't make a perfect world
mm-hmm.
apart from God, and ultimately heaven's the perfect
and
world.
And this is a theological mission,
it's a theological
message that really is really resonating with the population.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're living it, yeah.
And then the other half of the message is that people have free will, and that what these Marxist regimes do is they're overly deterministic, that everything's caused by socioeconomic forces and who owns the means of production and on and on and on, and human choice gets gets reduced, sometimes even eliminated. And John Paul's saying that even though we're all influenced by history, by society, by economy, still we're made in the image of God. We have freedom. We have free will. We can shape our destiny. It's not all determined for you by some immaterial, impersonal laws of history that Marx thinks he discovered. He takes Marxism very seriously. He reads about Marxism. In fact, one scholar said that John Paul knew Marxism better than the leaders of these countries. I mean, he seriously studied as a philosopher and a theologian, and is reading really dense, intense Marxist writings, in his leisure time. Whereas I don't think Honecker and Husak and those guys spent a lot of time doing that, or Ceausescu.
Yeah, no, I mean this is absolutely a fascinating point. The role of theology, of the religious message, yeah, that plays such a huge role in here. Because when we talk about free will here in the West, it's in philosophy classes, mm-hmm, and it might not resonate with a 21, 22-year-old mm-hmm undergraduate student, but I can imagine just in that environment where you are struggling for freedom, that message of free will, the message of original sin and trying to build a Tower of Babel is mm-hmm just so visual to you. It you're living that.
Yeah.
So that becomes the importance. Now, what about the grassroots? You mentioned the churches, this great story mm-hmm about the Zomos. That was a safety zone here. Mm-hmm. This becomes an area for organization mm-hmm for a lot of the underground movement and resistant movement. Does John Paul II know that this is going on? Does he encourage it? Is he worried about it?
Well, yeah, he knows, because he was the Archbishop of Krakow in the 50s and 60s and into the 70s, and so he's actually playing a role in this whole process of meeting, inviting dissidents to his engaged intellectuals who were critical of the regime, inviting them to dinner at his Archbishop's palace and getting them published in Catholic newspapers, and so he's definitely involved in sort of outreach and building connections and building networks. There was a book written in the 70s by Adam Michnik, famous Polish intellectual, an agnostic,
atheist,
at least. And he it was called The Church and the Left, where he argues that John Paul had this outreach to these leftist intellectuals who didn't like the communist regime. And he built a trust with them so that when it came crunch time in Poland and these social crises emerged, these left-wing intellectuals who normally wouldn't want anything to do with the Catholic Church actually turned to the Catholic Church for guidance, for leadership. Somebody went to church just to be part mm-hmm of the whole movement. And there was this real respect. Also, the fact that John Paul was not anti-Semitic, because a number of these leftist Jewish intellectuals were Jewish background, Michnik in particular. And so they could say, here's a guy that doesn't have an anti-Semitic bone in his body, and this is really great.
I think that's a really important point, because the Catholic Church, and this will be a topic for another podcast, mm-hmm, was accused of being too soft on the Nazis mm-hmm in Germany. And so one could only imagine that many of these Jewish intellectuals would be nervous about mm-hmm associating with the Catholic Church at the time. But it's John Paul II. His background, his anti-Semitic or pro-Semitic background, as you say, becomes crucial to this whole story and bringing people into the churches.
That helps, because if you're more on the left, the left isn't just communist. There are a lot of people on the left that don't like these communist regimes, and there's a whole variety. And if you're one of those guys, one of the things you wouldn't like about Poland was that sort of anti-Semitic traditions and that whole kind of traditional Polish Catholic mentality where the Jews were seen as an enemy. And John Paul transcends all that. And then you can say, well, here's a guy, he's not like these, maybe the priest in my hometown who I never liked because he's always complaining about Jews. So John Paul really, really was able to break through those barriers. And there's that whole, and he was part of a whole movement in the Polish church to kind of revitalize and re-energize it. And there have been other, bishops there. He got to the top.
Yeah, so absolutely, absolutely fascinating here that his role plays this. I'm going to do this. We're running out of time here on the podcast. One of the things I wanted to talk about was the post-communist Poland, but we're going to have to save that for another podcast.
Okay.
I have two other really critical questions mm-hmm that I want to get to. Is one, we've talked about Poland a lot, and naturally, John Paul II being from Poland, the Polish connection is huge. And Poland is one, in 1989, is one of the first dominoes to start moving everything. We oftentimes forget that when we think about the Berlin Wall falling, but that spring of that year, those elections become very critical. To what extent did the Vatican or John Paul II have relations similar with other nations in the Eastern Bloc? You mentioned he had visited Czechoslovakia, and one could think about Lithuania as being another one of the major Catholic nations there. Did he have outreach there as well?
Okay, in terms of that Soviet bloc, Lithuania was what the Soviet Union was most afraid of. This would spread into Lithuania because it was a Catholic country. It had a historical connection with Poland. They were the same country for centuries.
Right.
And so there was, a fair amount of dissident activity in Lithuania. Nothing like Poland, but there was still this fear that that stuff can spread into Lithuania. And West Ukraine was another place they were afraid of.
And they were right to do that. Lithuania is the first Baltic state to
the first Baltic
say,
state.
No, we're not part of the Soviet Union anymore.
And they always gave the Soviets the most trouble of the three Baltic states.
Right.
And so that's going to be, the other, Czechoslovakia, you know, the church was very tightly controlled in Czechoslovakia. In fact, except for Albania and North Korea, it was the worst place on earth for the Catholic Church. They had 13 dioceses and only three bishops. In 10 of the dioceses, the regime wouldn't approve who the Pope wanted as bishop, so they were just simply kept open. The Catholic, most of the priests belonged to pro-communist organization called Pacem in Terris. It was one of these kind of like a phony organization where the priests all have to spend a lot of time denouncing war, meaning the United States.
They go along with the Soviet propaganda.
So go with the Soviet propaganda. And so the regime controlled who got to be a priest. If you were charismatic, intelligent, you had a harder chance getting into seminary. So it was a very repressed church. The Archbishop himself of Prague didn't have control of his own newspaper. Stuff was printed that he didn't want to see. And under Paul VI, the earlier pope, Paul VI's approach was you bring about a better, you know, world peace, or you improve the world situation by state-to-state improvement of relations. So you get the Soviet Union, United States to sit down and make arms agreements and step back from confrontation. But when that's your approach, then all these dissident groups and, you know, priests that are resisting communism, they become a problem because they kind of upset the apple cart. So Paul VI really kind of wanted East Europe to kind of be calm so that U.S. and Soviet Union could improve their relations. John Paul II, however, he very much sees the power of engaging the population and the intellectuals and the church and these things. So he takes a different tack. He's much more likely to eager to have the church be more active. So he actually, under John Paul, the Archbishop of Prague, who was probably well into his 70s, if not 80s, he was very old, he gets sort of prodded to start being a little more active, being a little more supportive of some of the opposition things and standing up for the church's interests against the regime. So he's kind of pushing the church there. In Slovakia, there was a religious revival going on in the 80s where, you know, 500,000 people would turn up for, like, Catholic functions, you know, these big, feasts to honor Mary or special pilgrimage to some religious site. So there's this revival going on. Hungary was, the church wasn't oppressed too much in Hungary. It was kind of getting along with the government. So in Hungary, he didn't have that sort of an impact. But like I said, Poland was really unique. There's nothing like the case in Poland.
Well, let me ask, and again, Poland just absolutely critical in all of 1989 that, you know, is Poland and then Hungary and then Germany, Czechoslovakia, and all these things fall one after another. When to quote Solzhenitsyn, or to paraphrase Solzhenitsyn, when the lie is revealed, I mean that's, and John Paul has an important role in this. Let me do that. You're a historian, and one of the things that I love as a political scientist here are things that we call counterfactuals.
Okay,
where we get to rewrite history. We're not rewriting history in the way that maybe some scholars do and that, but we play a little intellectual game here where we change a component of history and then we ask ourselves, what if?
Right.
What would happen if that situation would have changed? And so this is, it's a good gut check to really tell us how important different events or people were in history. So let me give you this counterfactual. Had there been an Italian pope elected in 1978 who lived another decade or so, there was no Pope John Paul II, what if? What would have happened in the Soviet bloc?
Well, you know, that's a good question. You know, and it's the kind of approach like a scientist in a laboratory can take. You know, you can run the experiment again by changing variables. And fortunately or unfortunately, we can't rewind history, pull something out or put something in and play it again. But I think it's definitely worthwhile to think about those things. On the one hand, you know, Gorbachev himself actually said that John Paul was crucial in the fall of communism. He thinks he's the most important important factor. So that's definitely important. But as I said previously, Poland was becoming such a problem because, like I said, economic problems, the working class, the intellectuals, the church itself. I mean, Wojtyla's actions in Poland. If he never been elected pope, there would have the communists had a huge problem to deal with in Poland, and
they had him as archbishop.
Yeah, right. Something would have happened in Poland. And you had other leaders in the Polish church that were, you know, also, you know, important and very clever in how they dealt with the regime. So probably something, there would have been some sort of explosion of upheavals. But I think they would have been probably not as peaceful because, first of all, the regime would have had a freer hand to really violently crack down if it didn't have to worry about a Polish pope bringing this to everybody's attention.
The Vatican becomes a major player with a Polish pope.
And also, you have this Polish pope who's calming people down. And another thing, which I didn't mention, you know, the Polish church itself has different factions. And there are some, you know, in the Polish church that really, in a certain sense, some want to be oppositional. Like this Popieluszko, the priest you mentioned who got murdered, or we were talking about it earlier.
Right.
He gets murdered by, not by the regime itself, but by kind of rogue elements in the secret police.
Right.
He's a pro-solidarity priest. He's speaking out against martial law. He's running his sermons at his masses during martial law period. He's denouncing the regime, and he eventually gets, in 1984, he gets murdered.
Right.
So you had those people that were right on the side of the opposition with solidarity. That wasn't most priests, but there were some. Then you had people like Wojtyla that were kind of in the middle, wanting to, you know, push for human rights, but calm people down. But then you also had people that wanted to cut a sort of a deal with the government. And Cardinal Glemp, who was the head of the Polish church once Wojtyla moved to Rome and Cardinal Wyszyński died, Glemp was hoping to kind of leverage all these crises into a better situation for church. In other words, if we support the government, we'll get more churches, we'll get more slots in the seminaries, we'll get to have certain influence over, you know, marriage law and issues like abortion, you know,
and on.
So there was this idea that, you know, we can kind of like cut off solidarity, cut a deal with the government, and kind of almost like in this, almost like a corporate state where the Communist Party and the Catholic Church together manage things. And
a modus vivendi at the end of the state.
And that could have happened, and Wojtyla vetoes that. He kind of, you know, reaches into Poland and sides with solidarity and says, no, we're not going to cut this kind of a deal here. So those sorts of things. So you know, in a certain sense, these events were happening. It's hard to imagine communism still being around today. But like you say, in 1980, I thought it would last forever.
I would have said that in August of 1989.
In all honesty. And now, just how rotten it had been to the core in so many ways, but the thing is, it's how it collapsed. It really collapsed, except for Romania and maybe Albania. There wasn't a whole lot of bloodshed in how it collapsed.
And
the scenarios where it could have hung on a lot longer, especially if, you know, the regime and the church are cutting deals, that goes out the window with Wojtyla. And the scenario where it's just this horrible bloodbath and Polish civil war, I think that goes out the window, or at least becomes more unlikely because of Wojtyla. So a lot of times it's not so much what's going to happen, but how it happens.
How
it happens really, in a certain sense, essentially affects what happens. You know, a violent solution is going to be different than a peaceful one.
This is absolutely fascinating. We're at the end of our time here, and you know, so we, you know, through this past hour, we really realized that the crucial role that John Paul II plays in the downfall of communism, not only in facilitating it, but facilitating the peaceful manner that it comes about. I wish we would have more time to talk to you about what happens after the fall of communism in Poland, but we're sure to have you back on another podcast interview. Again, we were talking with James Felak, professor of history at the University of Washington. And James, thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you very much, Tony. I enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.